father, Merv Duffy, here in Auckland, interviewing Father John O'Connor, currently on sabbatical. Where are you, John?
I'm in Italy at the moment, Merv. Merv, I'm a little nervous being interviewed by you.
Indeed, you should be.
Be gentle, be loving.
Wishful thinking. My reason for interviewing you, John, is to find out about the National Liturgy Office, which New Zealand has a position. It used to have, following the Second Vatican Council, a National Liturgy Commission. Mm-hmm. And maybe start there. Why did the Second Vatican Council recommend there should be liturgy commissions?
Before the Second Vatican Council, the general idea was that the church knew what to do, and the church was the priests and the bishops, the people who celebrated liturgy, and the people who had 400 years earlier prepared the texts. But in fact, most priests know very quickly that we learn most about liturgy from the people who come and celebrate the liturgy. Like, the people are our teachers. And so I think that was a general sense at the council, particularly communicated through Sacrosanctum Concilium, the liturgy constitution, that we are all involved in this. This is not just the work of one priest. And very oddly, like, people in New Zealand may have forgotten that before the revisions following the Second Vatican Council, there really was very often a great disconnection between what happened either side of the altar rails. So I remember a priest of our diocese, Kevin Burns, will be known to some of you, who was ordained in 1959. And Kevin said that when he went to Greymouth, which is his first parish, a place that's significant for both you and me, Merv, you were baptized there.
I was born and baptized there, yes.
Oh. Well, Kevin said that when he went as a newly ordained priest at the masses, which might have 200 or 300 people present at St. Patrick's there in Greymouth, the job of the server at the just before communion was to look down and see if anyone was moving, because the presumption was that no one would come to communion. So there was actually no connection at all. So certainly people weren't doing readings, and there was no music at those masses. The Second Vatican Council helped us to see the liturgy as the work of the entire church. So that was one of the reasons, in response to the question you ask, the commission.
You've been in the position of a co-director of the National Liturgy Office for the last 5 years. What situation, what was the status quo when you came into the job?
Well, when I came into the job, initially I was appointed as an acting director on my own, with the knowledge that there would be an administrative assistant appointed. And there had been some great directors in the past. We found a website and an office absolutely full of resources. And very quickly we got advertised a position of administrative assistant, and Catherine Gibbs came into that role. And after a year or so working with Catherine, seeking to bring these resources, or make these resources available to parishes and schools and chaplaincies, it became clear that Catherine and I were working together. So we asked the bishops that we be appointed as co-directors, which they were happy to do. So that's been the situation we've been working in. But we found a lot of resources, but on the whole, most parish liturgy committees and school liturgy groups had no idea that the National Liturgy Office existed and that it could be helpful. So our primary role was to take the office to the people. And of course, the moment we decided to do that and got started on the work and had a real energy and passion for it, COVID hit, which meant that we couldn't travel. So that really became a major rethink, because it certainly, for the first COVID lockdown, people were very preoccupied, like, providing liturgy resources is something that we did. We were never great supporters of liturgy online or live streamed masses, although they are necessary and they have served a very important purpose. But we provided some resources for them. There was a Good Friday when we were all in lockdown. The entire country, Aotearoa, was in lockdown. So we organized an online Good Friday service with people from around the country participating. That was a great event. But that really COVID and the after effects of it and keeping us with parishes not being, even once the lockdown was lifted, we weren't inviting each other around that much. So it was really 2 or 3 years before we started to again take the resources that we have to the parishes. So that was the situation that existed. Some great directors, great resources, but a need for these resources to be made more available for the people.
One of my experiences is that there are a lot of structures that are diocesan in New Zealand, but there aren't very many national Catholic bodies. And there's always a bit of a tension between national and diocesan. So there are diocesan liturgy offices, for example, the Auckland Diocese. How was the relationship between your national office and those offices?
Well, there really was only the Auckland Liturgy Office operating, and they had some great people. They had a staff there for a while of 2 or 3 people doing some great work for Auckland. But there was another diocese then 5 years ago that had an operating diocesan liturgical commission, but there were no other dioceses that had functioning bodies. But people just seem to get on with it. Like, people have a strong sense since the educational formation that did happen in the country after the revisions in the late 1960s, people did have a sense that they knew what to do, so they didn't need any more help. So they knew that they were, the liturgy committee had to plan these masses, was often the term used. And they would begin by saying, well, what is the theme of the readings? Well, of course, readings and masses don't quite have themes in that way. But it was very hard to shift that. One of the examples that I've often used with groups is thinking, well, you know, what should we be doing at Mass on Sunday? How should people feel when they leave Mass? People say, oh, they should feel uplifted. They should feel happy. They should feel bright. Well, I remember one Sunday a number of years ago at the 8 o'clock Mass at Our Lady of Victories in Sockburn Christchurch. And there was a family who had gathered to celebrate the 50th wedding anniversary, and they'd gathered from all over the world. There must have been about 30 people sitting in the front, 3 or 4 seats. And then I noticed, like, they were very happy. And then I noticed just before Mass began, this elderly man came in quietly, genuflected, knelt in the back. And I thought, this is the Mass. Like, at 10 o'clock the night before, he had phoned me to say his wife was dying. I went round and she died. And here he was at 8 o'clock the next morning, before his family arrived from different parts of the country, knowing he had to go to Mass and wanting to go to Mass and going to Mass. Well, do we have happy Mass or sad Mass? Well, the answer of the church is we have Mass, and it doesn't have a theme that slants it in a happy way or a sad way. We just celebrate Mass, and that is the most inclusive thing we can do. The moment we start to say this will be happy Mass, this will be sad Mass, the moment we say this will be, you know, we want a happy Mass, well, that rules out a lot of people who are having enormous financial struggles, health struggles, relationship struggles, who may not feel at home there. Well, at the Mass, celebrated well, everyone can feel at home.
I've noticed that there's a tendency to advertise a family Mass, and that can actually be very off-putting for those who are not with a family or not married or separated, right, or whatever the situation of life is.
I agree, Merv. I think the motivation for doing that is very well intended, of course. If we say family, then it's more likely that families will come, and we want to get people into church. In some ways, I think we have to stop trying to get people into church. And I often think with First Communion parents, 90% of them who are not at Mass regularly, so they come along for preparation session, and all we really seem to do is try and convince them they should come to church. Well, it doesn't work. Someone asked me at a session, they said, well, you've been, you know, chatting with us for an hour, you haven't yet told us you have to go to that we have to go to Mass. I said I haven't, because the simple fact is that if I tell you you have to go to Mass, it will make zero difference to what you do. It won't make any difference at all. But, and I also add that, to be completely honest, whether or not you go to Mass is not going to cause me to lose any sleep at all. Like, I actually, you are old enough and wise enough to make these decisions for yourself. I said, but let me tell you why I go to Mass. And then for 5 or 10 minutes, I share with them why I go. I think trying to get people to Mass, which is often the main motivation of sacramental preparation, it has never worked. But if we, again, returning to, I think, the major tool we have for evangelization and for faith formation and education is the sacraments. So if we celebrate the sacraments well, people will get them. And also we need to appreciate as well, I think, that the sacraments are actually an acquired taste. And to tell someone they go to Mass and to convince them and to drag them to Mass could be very, very unhelpful, because they will get there, and because they haven't had developed an acquired taste, they will feel completely out of place and excluded, even in the most inclusive, inverted commas there, celebration. We have to, many of the popes recently, and many very wise teachers say, look, it's very important that the church be not afraid of getting small. Of course, all our motivation is to get big. But if we simply said, well, what is the Mass? And how can we celebrate it well? It would be very attractive, not to everyone, but to those who were seeking Christ. And I think that's very important. If we get the sacraments right, everything else will fall into place.
So you're out to save the world by good liturgy.
Okay, short answer, yep, yes. And the evidence is it's possible because it's happened. Like, and by good liturgy, liturgy is not just something that happens for an hour every day in a church, for an hour on a Sunday every day, or half an hour every weekday in a church. Our real difficulty is that we're trying to promote what we call liturgy, which is very often not so much liturgy, but rituals. We're trying to promote these rituals, but we forget that the rituals of the liturgy only make sense to someone who is seeking to live liturgically. And what do I mean by that? Well, living liturgically, fundamentally means we're not afraid of crucifixion. Like, we're not afraid to go through suffering, sacrifice, and death to resurrection. Now, if I think that's a foreign idea and completely unattractive and I don't want it in my own life, what we do, what a parish does on Sundays, will make no sense at all. The best thing you can get out of it is the coffee and company's good. But if we are saying, in my life there is struggle and suffering and anxieties and griefs, how can I make sense of this? Because I've tried to get rid of it and I can't. Then we realize that baptism is actually a saying yes to the cross. That's why we're baptized into the suffering and death and then resurrection of Christ. That's why fonts, the earliest fonts that they've excavated, are actually shaped like cross-shaped graves in the ground, which they filled with water, and you would go down into the death of Christ, into the grave with Christ, and rise, come up, be clothed with white on the other side. But that's living liturgically. So our real problem is not trying to communicate, you should come because the community is important, which is reducing the liturgy to another communal celebration. That's not the way to communicate liturgy. Communicating liturgy is about saying, well, look honestly at your own life. Like, what are your joys, hopes, griefs, anxieties? Christian faith is the one thing that gives human suffering and death even meaning. There's nothing else that gives suffering and death in human life meaning. That's the wonderful thing about the Mass. It makes sense here.
Once COVID was over and you were able to take your show on the road, who did you talk to? What was the agenda?
So what we were discovering is that people didn't realize that Vatican Council wasn't a break with the past. There was a real continuity, which particularly in liturgy had begun in a very clear and traceable way for 150 years earlier. And that's why you slipped in there earlier, Merva, mention of the dialogue mass. That's why my first experience of the mass was in a little town on the banks of the Waitaki River called Otamatata, where I was spent the first couple of years of my life. But my parents and others, who they kept in contact with for many years after they left there, talked about a great priest they had who had them reading the scriptures aloud in English while he, keeping the letter of the law, read them silently in Latin. And so that was going on. This is the 1950s. And then, of course, particularly in schools, not boarding schools, but secondary schools, the opportunity for more dialogue in the Tridentine form of the Mass began. So, for example, before then, the people were completely silent. Most people at Mass today don't appreciate this, that when I talked about the distinction between what happened one side of the altar rails and the other, not only were the people not coming to communion, which was a major concern of the earlier years of last century, but the people were actually not saying anything during the Mass, and there was no music at most of the Masses, so they weren't singing. So the server
did the responses.
And you could probably still do them, Merv.
Some of them, yes.
See, the two servers, well, there could be more, but certainly one or two, would always respond on behalf of the people. So the people were completely silent. But that gradually changed. So when the priest would say, I have almost no Latin, but Dominus Vobiscum, the servers would respond on behalf of the people.
Et cum spiritu tuo.
So you can still do it, Viv. So all of this was going on, but when we study liturgy, and I think when I first studied liturgy, what I was studying was rubric, and not only rubric, but creative rubric. So the sense that we had was, how can we take this raw material that the church has given us in a missal and a lectionary and make it work? And that's where we ran into an enormous amount of problem, I would suggest, over about 40 years, that what we were given in the missal and the lectionary and in the understanding of the Mass was seen as a starting point. So we began to create the liturgy rather than celebrate the liturgy. I had a great experience, Merv. I was in Winton, of all places, for a parish mission last year. And in one of the sessions, a woman made a comment, sort of sotto voce. She just quietly said, oh, no, no, no. And I didn't quite hear it, but I knew it was good. I said, I'm sorry, I missed what you said. And she said, the best kept secret in the church is weekday Mass. And immediately I understood what she was saying, because very often when you go to Mass on a Sunday, there's a lot happening, particularly because many parishes have cancelled so many Masses that more people are at, and they try to make everything happen at two or three Masses. I remember growing up in Timaru, this seems bizarre now, but there was Mass every Sunday morning, starting every half hour from 6:30 to 10:30 in Timaru City of 30,000 people, 6:37, 7:38, 8:39, 9:30, 10, 10:30, as well as two on a Sunday evening. And then the vigil Masses on a Saturday were introduced in the late 1970s, and that changed it. So Mass was very available. And you could go to a Mass where it was like a weekday Mass. If you went to Sacred Heart in Timaru at 6:30 on a Sunday morning, the Mass took half an hour, but it's not about the time. It was celebrated with full dignity and silence, and it was beautiful. So when this woman said the best kept secret in the church is weekday Mass, what she was saying is, you know, there's too much going on. And if you're an extrovert, look, you'll feel quite at home and you'll love it. But some people, particularly, I think of that man before, when your wife died the night before, but you want to go to Mass, you feel the desire and need, it's not safe. Because you'll arrive there at the door and they'll greet with the news here and say, oh, how are you? Haven't seen you here before. What happened? You know, have you had a good week? Tell me what happened. Well, actually, my wife died last night. It's just too hard. And also, there are a very large number of good people who no longer are at Mass on Sunday because they don't feel, you know, often our catechesis hasn't been the best, and they don't understand that what they're carrying isn't actually what they would have once called mortal sin. So they feel as though they can't participate, and it's their goodness that is leading them to this discernment. Often the sacraments have lost a priority. Like we have, you know, the sacraments are not that easily available. And our general understanding, for example, for the sacrament of reconciliation is Christmas and Easter at the second rite, which means you're relying on the parish to organize your participation in the sacrament. Well, the church has always taught, go anytime, ask any priest at any time. If you see him on the street, say, Father, have you got 2 minutes? It's fine. Like the people were in control of their participation in the sacrament. But when we cut down the number of masses, so Mass is not celebrated now in as many places, which is completely understandable for pastoral or practical or economic reasons. But we've also we've made it more difficult for people to be at Mass. So again, my conviction is that the sacraments are our primary instrument of the church, of evangelization. And when this woman said, the weekday Mass, best kept secret in the church, I thought, yep, I think that's right. Can I add quickly, I'm sorry to ramble on here a bit, Merv, but I'm just thinking now of saying when I said once a few years ago to one of the teachers, she said, oh, it would be good to have Mass more with the children. And I said, come every morning. There's Mass at 9 o'clock, school's just begun, the parents are maybe still here every morning. No, we can't. I said, well, okay, you are overseeing your curriculum. No, we haven't got time to prepare. I said, don't prepare anything. Just bring the children. Her Mass will take 25 minutes maybe, but we haven't got time to, you know, train the children to read and to get 6 children to do prayers of the table. If you want to, that's great. But you don't have to. You can simply come and be present. But this is often very difficult to communicate because we've misunderstood, and this is a key, this goes all the way back to 1903, Trella Solicitudini, full active conscious participation. Now that wasn't an invention of the Second Vatican Council. It's all the way through earlier documents as well. But we've misunderstood the full conscious act of participation to be everyone who's there is doing something. Well, yes, everyone there ideally is doing something, but they're not leaving their seat or speaking aloud to do it. You know, there's something going on. When I am understanding what's happening here at this Mass, that somehow the suffering of the week or the uncertainty about my future is coming into my consciousness and Christ is encountering it and moving it forward. So when I leave the church, I'm a little bit lighter.
You seem to be advocating for a relatively sparse liturgy where they, well, to steal a phrase, they do the red and say the black.
I'm advocating for all the available forms of liturgy that the church allows. And we now have parishes which tend to be, especially in cities, larger. So rather than presume that every Mass has to have a full choir and 2 people doing the readings and someone else doing the prayers of intercession for extraordinary ministers for Holy Communion, that will be 1 or 2 of the Masses at the weekend. But I know that in most cities it's very difficult to find a Sunday Mass before 8 o'clock in the morning. Well, that might have been okay 50 years ago when the only thing happening on a Sunday morning in any of our towns or cities was church. like in Timaru, growing up in Timaru in the 1960s, 70s, the only sound on a Sunday morning was church bells and people going to church. The dairy was open from, I think, 8:30. You could get gas, but literally nothing else was open and no sport was played. So people could get to an 8, 9, 10 o'clock mass, but now they can't. But at that very time, the people are looking for a 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning mass, because people, I think, now are much less afraid of early mornings than they used to be. There's a whole new 5 o'clock in the morning movement. Have you seen that, Merv? If you get up at 3 o'clock, you give yourself all this precious time before anything else is moving. It's wonderful. So there's a new movement. So there's nothing wrong with having a 6:30 mass on a Sunday morning, 7 o'clock mass. And it won't have music. And it will only take half an hour. But it will be 100% fully the mass.
Coming back to this 5 years in the National Liturgy Office, what were some of the accomplishments of the office? What were there any interesting decisions by the bishops with respect to liturgy in New Zealand?
I think it's been a difficult time because of COVID, and many of the bishops' discussions and decisions had to centre on, well, what do we do? Like from the end of, when was it, the beginning of 2020, how do we respond to this? And the bishop's focus has been leading the church in New Zealand through that. Now, the National Liturgy Office is not a decision-making body. It's an agency of the bishop's conference. So we, every 6 months, would submit to the bishops a report on how we saw things, and then we would act on the things that they focused on in response. So a lot of what we were doing, Merv, was centered around COVID. In providing resources, and there are many different Sundays for different reasons and themes and focuses through the year, which we provided resources for. Catherine was great on this, working on the website.
And we should advertise your website. The URL is?
NLO. Just type NLO Aotearoa, NLO New Zealand, and you'll get to the Liturgy Office website. And because we're right at the moment, like Catherine finished up in the role 6 months ago, and I'm finishing up at the moment, so we are awaiting an appointment from the bishops. So the website may not be operating right at the moment as efficiently as it has under Catherine for the last 3 or 4 years.
Okay, to bring this interview to an end, what's your parting message as you finish up in this job? What would you advise your successor? What would you advise the New Zealand Church? What's the key takeaway?
Okay, the first thing I would say is when I got the job, I was interviewed by New Zealand Catholic, by Michael Otto, and who was the editor of New Zealand Catholic then. And one of the comments that I made that he wrote up, I think, as a heading is, Father John O'Connor believes, if we get the liturgy right, everything else will fall into place. So I would come directly back to that. Like, liturgy is so important. I would add to that immediately, we must stop trying to get people there because it's an acquired taste. But instead of trying to get people to the Mass, we should, in our conversations, encourage people to see that the only way to truly live is to live liturgically. So when there is suffering or grief or anxiety, you know, this is not a sign that something's wrong or a sign of the end. And that's why this interview will be in audio, but Merv and I are doing it by video, so you can see a cross on the wall behind me. See that cross, the crucifix, and the reason that we put the crucifix in places of prominence with a dead man on it, with the corpus on the crucifix, is that for us, this is not a symbol of end, death, finish. This is pathway. So if people are living liturgically, it means that whatever surfaces in life, you know, I think of so many tragedies where people have become convinced that there is no way forward. You know, I think of the awful tragedies of 15 and 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds who cannot see a way forward. Well, the whole point of our faith is, however you're feeling, however awful and wretched it is, there is a way forward, and it's by living liturgically. Now, the moment we start to understand that and live liturgically, we will begin to seek out the places where this is the reminder, where this is the, and that is the Mass.
The crucifix behind you is a reproduction of the San Damiano cross, which has a living Christ on it. And St. Francis heard the words from that cross, build up my church. What you've done to build up the church in this past 5 years, our thanks to you, Father John.
Thank you, Bev.